This is the takeaway.
This is the takeaway.
This is the takeaway.
This is the takeaway for Wednesday, August 16th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. 2 days ago, the president went on script at the White House to condemn racism after Charlottesville. Yesterday, he opened up and let his true thoughts out.
You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent.
The president said both sides were at fault when white supremacists demonstrated in Charlottesville and after one in their ranks allegedly killed a woman. The president also said there were fine people among those carrying torches and chanting anti-Jewish slogans. A number of Republicans have denounced the president's comments, but few as strongly as Congressman Leonard Lance of New Jersey's 7th District. He directed his statement on Twitter right at the president, and we have Congressman Lance with us now to explain. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
I'd like to read the statement that you made on Twitter yesterday, Congressman. It says, Mr. President, there is only one side against white supremacists, neo-Nazis, anti-Semites, and the KKK. They have no place in America or the GOP. Beyond that tweet, Congressman, what's your message to the president?
My message is that we have to work together and make sure that society moves forward. And certainly, there is no place in the United States for white supremacists or neo-Nazis or anti-Semites or those who belong to the KKK. These are reprehensible groups, and they should be condemned.
Now, the problem, Congressman, that I see with your tweet, or not with your tweet, but with its ramifications, that there does seem to be a place in the GOP for some of these groups, at least according to the leader of your party and his statements yesterday.
I have been a Republican my whole adult life, and I believe the Republican Party should be the party of Abraham Lincoln, and I have identified myself as an Eisenhower Republican, and that is the Republican Party that I know, and it's the Republican Party to which I belong.
So if that, Congressman, is the Republican Party to which you belong, and I'm quite sure that you believe that, what should you do about it? There is a tendency in these situations, and we've seen other situations where the president has said incendiary things, where members of Congress say they're troubled by the president's words or they don't like it or he shouldn't say them, and then we move on. Is this different?
I think that we have an obligation to speak out and to indicate where we stand. I will support this president or as I supported President Obama when I thought they were right, and where I thought they were wrong, I will not support them. And I certainly do not support any toleration of these hate groups.
But do you think that members of Congress or members of the president's party should now take some action? Do you think that Speaker Ryan should speak out more forcefully?
I think the speaker has spoken out, but perhaps we should have hearings regarding various hate groups in the United States. I would imagine that would be for the Judiciary Committee, but certainly there is no place in our society for these hate groups.
Still, Congressman, it raises the question of whether Republicans who find the president's words so abhorrent and his opinions apparently about both sides in a racist confrontation would do anything about it. Would you support a censure motion in the House? Would you vote for one?
I hope that the president will speak again as he spoke on Monday to indicate that there is no place in our society for these groups. And I would like to make sure that he moves in that direction, and I urge him to move in that direction.
But part of the problem, Congressman, with the statement on Monday, and I think you saw this too, a lot of people liked that statement. The president made it on teleprompter, very scripted, and then left the room. And then yesterday at Trump Tower, the president was off script. He wasn't even supposed to take questions, and he really spent some time talking about what he really thinks. Don't you think that's right?
Certainly, he was not on a teleprompter at Trump Tower, and I have no objection to having presidents speak from a teleprompter, but you're right that he was not on a teleprompter when he spoke at Trump Tower.
Well, the question isn't really about the teleprompter itself, as you know, Congressman. It's about when the president makes a calibrated statement from the White House that's delivered to him by staff, which is what presidents do, and then 48 hours later or a day later undoes it all when he's off script and when he's speaking from the heart.
I believe that the president should move in the direction I have suggested, as have others. And I was pleased with the statement of Senator McCain and of Governor Romney. And certainly I associate myself with those statements and with others in the Republican Party in Congress and out.
So, Congressman Lance of New Jersey, where's the point then where it's too far for members of the Republican Party like you? You say you're still willing to support the president when you think he's right. At the same time, you're tweeting to all of America, implying that the president is on the wrong side of racism and on the wrong side of anti-Semitism and white supremacy. Does there come a point, where is the point, where a Republican member of Congress would decide that they made a mistake in having Donald Trump as the head of their party?
I had supported Governor Christie as to be the Republican nominee last year. I'm from New Jersey, and I know Governor Christie. I think last year's presidential race was not edifying on either side, and I indicated where I thought Mr. Trump was wrong in various aspects, including, for example, his criticisms of a very fine judge of Mexican ancestry in Indiana and the Access Hollywood matter. I also thought that Hillary Clinton should not have said that half of Donald Trump's supporters are deplorable. I don't think the contest in 2016 will go down as a second Lincoln-Douglas race, and I hope that the president will move in the direction I have suggested, and I will continue to speak out where I think he's wrong.
So it sounds like pretty clearly, Congressman Lance, that if the president can get back to his scripted message of Monday, that you are willing to keep supporting his agenda.
I support a portion of his agenda. I did not vote for the health care bill in the House. I did not think that it was moving in the right direction. And I'm a member of what is known as the Problem Solvers Caucus, and it's completely bipartisan. Half of us are members of the Republican Party, half in the Democratic Party. And I would hope the White House would look at the proposal we have put forth to stabilize the individual market in the health care issue. And I hope, Todd, we can move to tax reform. That is an important issue. And I want diplomacy to work regarding North Korea and other hot spots across the globe. I hope that the president will move in that direction. And where he doesn't, I will be critical.
So it sounds then, Congressman Lance, you know, a lot of people are wondering today what other people in power, people like Republican congressmen, are going to do about what they see coming from the White House and a president who equivocates and sanctions both sides of a racist confrontation. And I have to say, it sounds from our conversation like the answer is pretty much nothing.
I respectfully disagree, Todd. I think it might be appropriate to hold hearings on extremist groups in the United States, like the KKK and neo-Nazis and anti-Semitic groups. This disturbs me greatly, and I would favor hearings in that regard, both in the House and the Senate.
So hearings may be scheduled. We'll have to see. You know, Congressman, there are 10 Confederate statues in the U.S. Capitol. They're in Statuary Hall. They're all around the building. Do you think those statues should go?
I certainly think that's a possibility, and I can distinguish between George Washington and Thomas Jefferson on one hand, and Jefferson Davis or John C. Calhoun on the other, and I don't know precisely the statues in the building, but I certainly can distinguish between these figures in American history, and I think that might indeed be appropriate, as you have suggested.
Congressman Leonard Lance, Republican of New Jersey's 7th Congressional District. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Everybody said his statement was beautiful. The statement I made on Saturday, the first statement,
was a fine statement.
All this week, we've been hearing from you on the events in Charlottesville, on white supremacy and violence. But now we hear just from some of our listeners who support President Trump and how they reacted to his remarks yesterday.
As far as the media goes, Donald Trump can do nothing right. He responded in a very appropriate way, very quickly.
Kenneth Lancey is a Trump supporter and a former Democrat from Ohio.
When they're complaining about simple words that he didn't use, when President Obama for 8 years could not say Islamic terrorism, that's disgusting. They should take a good hard look at themselves and realize that if they continue down this way, they're only hurting America. Donald Trump, thank God for you. He has stood up to Korea, and at this point, they have taken a pass. That doesn't happen just by accident. Leadership is what makes things happen. He is doing an excellent job. The media should go take a vacation because there's nothing he's going to say that's going to make them happy.
We also heard from Matt Olson. He's from Ellsworth, Wisconsin.
In response to Donald Trump's speech, the truth is he's kind of right on several points. The point being, not wanting to release a statement until the full facts come out is probably the best thing to do. In regards to both sides being held responsible for the violence, once again, not PC, but it also appears to be true. What the driver did was evil, and I hope he gets everything he deserves for punishment-wise. But President Trump did point out that there was extremism on both sides, and that is a fact. What he said about Washington was also interesting. He did mention George Washington was a slave owner, you know, and kind of like, where does it stop?
Blame all sides? Absolutely. I looked at the pictures.
And that's Kevin Loney, a Trump supporter from Manchester, New Hampshire.
Did he miss a chance to bring America together? No, because the crowd in front of him just continued to pour gas about everything but what happened in Virginia. And yes, the neo-Nazis and white supremacists were there, but also there were a bunch of young people, baseball caps, black handkerchiefs over their face, backpacks, and clubs. The whole tone of the press conference, I think they should fire all the White House correspondents, and I have thought about this for a long time. I was very happy with the way that he took them on, very much like some very high-powered presidents I've worked for in industry. It's what I hoped for when I voted for him and when I vote for him again. I listened to a left-leaning station in Boston. They didn't mention these young people in baseball caps with covered faces. All they kept talking about were these armed-to-the-teeth, long-gun, neo-fascist white supremacists. It's about time we look at both sides of the equation. I applaud the president for saying there's two sides to every story. He condemned both sides, but there still is two sides.
Reactions from some of our listeners who support President Trump. Thanks to Kenneth and Matt and Kevin for weighing in. You can have your voice heard as well. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And later on in the show, we'll hear from a World War II veteran with a much wider lens and his own perspective on this moment of political and social upheaval. Stay with us. Last night in Baltimore, crews worked overnight to take down two Confederate monuments. This was part of the city's pledge to remove four statues tied to the Confederacy from public spaces. And on this program earlier this week, we heard from the mayor of Lexington, Kentucky, who said Charlottesville compelled him to accelerate his plans to remove similar monuments from his city. It's just one way in which the weekend's events are rippling beyond Virginia, and it became even more prominent in the national dialogue yesterday at the president's impromptu press conference. The president said, if we take down statues of Robert E. Lee and Confederate leaders, will monuments to George Washington and Thomas Jefferson come down next? Van Newkirk is with The Atlantic. He's here to talk about the debate over monuments and about where this conversation goes from here. Van, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Last night in Baltimore, Van Newkirk, there were some remarkable images, 3 a.m., 4 a.m., of those statues coming down. Your reaction?
Oh, these were, again, really powerful images. The Lee Jackson statue especially has been up since 1948. It's been a fixture of Baltimore. And I think seeing it go, seeing sort of this rapid impetus nationwide to take them down, is a, I think we'll look back on it in years and say, wow, this was a bit of a paradigm shift, perhaps.
Interesting, you said that statue went up in 1948. It did not go up right after the Civil War or at the turn of the 20th century. It went up at a time in Maryland and in a lot of other places where a lot of white people in politics were defending their heritage.
Right. I can sympathize with people who feel like a big piece of what they remember of Baltimore, of their own heritage, is being taken away, right? But I think we have to, as a country, realize that most Confederate statues, most of the Confederate flags that have been incorporated into state flags, most of the South's especially embrace of symbols of the Confederacy, it came at a time when white supremacy was a regime, during Jim Crow. In response to black activism, when people who were trying to, quote unquote, take back the country. So we have to think about the fact that these monuments are actually monuments to a Confederacy that endorsed and fought for slavery, but also to the ensuing 70 years of white supremacy.
The president got on this point in a way yesterday, Van Newkirk, when he was talking about the statues and talking about the Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville that was at the center of the original protest there. And I said it before, he said, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, if these come down, then what about George Washington and Thomas Jefferson? The president says they were all slave owners, which is a fact, but it seems to miss another fundamental truth, which is that two of those people I mentioned founded the country, and two of them did all they could to destroy it.
Yeah, I think perhaps unwittingly, Trump did acknowledge sort of our need to complicate history and think about the slave-owning past and histories of many of our great founding fathers and leaders. But again, like you said, Lee statues, Jackson statues, statues of leaders of the Confederacy, statues of Nathan Forrest, who was also a Klan leader after he left the Confederacy, after he lost. Those are not usually, they didn't come up right after the war. They didn't come up right after the South lost. They came up, and this is why so many of them are statues of figures in victory. They came up during a time when the South was building its new white supremacist Jim Crow identity around defiance, around massive resistance, around the entire region's their decision to not move forward with civil rights, to basically defy the federal government in a way that was reminiscent of the way the Confederacy decided to secede. And so we have to realize and recognize that, and also think about the communities who live within the shadows of those statues.
So we've talked a lot about Confederate monuments and other monuments on this show before. We've had lots of people advocating on different sides of where to keep them, where to put them, take them down, move them to a museum, what have you. Do you see something fundamentally different that's going on now? I know it's only been a day or three, so maybe it's a little early to ask you this question, but do you?
We'll see. I think what's happening now is still a bit on the periphery. We haven't penetrated the deepest bastions of Confederate veneration, say in Virginia and Alabama. And those are places where there are actually laws against doing this kind of thing. North Carolina, the people who pulled down the statue in Durham will be likely prosecuted for that. We don't know if there's any mass impetus in that state for pulling down other Confederate statues or for, say, changing things that are named after former Confederate governors who became governors of the state. So I don't know yet. I do think there is impetus in the liberal pockets in the South, especially. So Baltimore, New Orleans, Charlottesville, which, you know, is the site of the university. But I don't know how far that can spread to other parts in the places where there are the most statues.
So that's the monuments, Van Newkirk, and I want to ask you about the aftermath of the president's remarks yesterday. Well, Monday when he was on script and yesterday when he really opened up to the media about how he felt about these things. I know that you, as a journalist on social media and in your reporting, were really surveying the reaction to the president yesterday, saying both sides were at fault in Charlottesville, to saying there were fine people among the torch-carrying protesters around the statue of Robert E. Lee. What have you taken away over the last day or two?
One thing I would like to focus on is the black community in Charlottesville, the people who had to come in, who had to watch 500 people with torches, who were wearing Klan hoods, who had swastikas come into their neighborhoods and basically relive and reenact the scenes of the past. And to have the president come and say both sides are at fault here, or, you know, when only one side allegedly killed someone, it doesn't seem to people in that community, and I think people in marginalized communities as a whole, that the president is interested in sticking up for them. And that's a strong message. I think we haven't seen a message that strong from a president on race in a while. And unfortunately, it is not so great a message.
A message received from the president's remarks at Trump Tower yesterday. Monuments come down in Baltimore in the aftermath of Charlottesville. Van Newkirk of The Atlantic, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Zwillick. President Trump came to office promising to undo the North American Free Trade Agreement. He since decided to stay in the deal, but to renegotiate it. And those talks start today in Washington. There'll be more talks to come in Mexico and Canada in the weeks to come. NAFTA came into effect back in 1994. It's had a huge impact on trade between these three countries. Joining me to talk about the Trump administration's demands and what it means to renegotiate with Canada and Mexico in a global economy is Matt Gold. He's adjunct professor of law at Fordham University and the former deputy assistant U.S. trade representative for North America. Professor, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Nice to have you, sir. What's at stake here in these new negotiations over NAFTA, and how big of a negotiation are we talking about?
Not as big as people think. What's at stake is a series of technical problems with the agreement that the United States has been struggling with for more than 23 years that we'd like to fix. The Trump administration, as required by statute, published a wish list of about 50 to 70 things that we would like to change. And those issues have been trade irritants between the United States and Canada and the United States and Mexico for quite a long time.
Now, hang on. Saying technical issues around the margins that are irritants is a very different message from what President Trump ran on, promising to burn up NAFTA and undo a bad deal.
That's true. President Trump, and to be fair, also Bernie Sanders, pandered on the campaign trail to people's desire to scapegoat NAFTA in particular and trade agreements in general for a lot of problems that are not caused by NAFTA or trade agreements. Trump described NAFTA as being, well, on a scale from 1 to 100, about a 30. And those numbers are mine. He used words, but about a 30, and he promised to improve it to a 100. The reality is NAFTA is about a 92, and these negotiations, if we got everything on the wish list, it would be about a 95 or 6. We'll probably get less than a third of the items on the wish list, and we'll improve it from a 92 to a 93 or a 94.
Give me a sense of what's on the wish list and your best hope for getting to 94.
Well, two big issues that jump right out have to do with labor and the environment. This was the first agreement that required other countries entering into a free trade agreement with the United States to meet certain minimum labor standards and environmental standards, which was particularly important for us for Mexico. The original agreement negotiated by George H.W. Bush did not have those provisions, but when Bill Clinton came into office, he negotiated those, but they were not part of the main agreement since the main agreement was already completed by H.W. Bush before Clinton came into office. The labor and environmental provisions that Clinton added were side agreements, and because they were side agreements, they were not subject to the strong enforcement mechanisms of the main agreement. So they're there, but they're not enforceable. And one of the big things the United States has wanted is to make those requirements of Mexico and Canada part of the main agreement so that the United States can use the enforcement provisions of the main agreement. And I think we'll get that.
Well, I heard a bunch of experts the other day. I was actually delving into NAFTA a little bit. Matt Gold, you might be happy to hear that. But they were worrying out loud that negotiators might try to unscramble the eggs here. You know, that the economies of Mexico, Canada, and the United States aren't like yolks and whites. They said they're scrambled eggs. And they were actually concerned that there might be an effort to unscramble them, which you can't really do.
That's correct. You can't. The three Economies are greatly integrated. There are many sectors that literally straddle the borders. The automotive sector, the way it straddles the U.S.-Canadian border, for example. There are component manufacturers on both sides of the border, assemblers on both sides of the border, markets on both sides of the border. Some subcomponents will pass forth across the border multiple times before they're in a finished automobile. And it is truly impossible for the United States to withdraw from NAFTA or Mexico and Canada. And what we've heard from all of the major American industrial and agricultural sectors since President Trump has been talking about renegotiating NAFTA since he came into office is do no harm. They want to make sure that whatever President Trump does, that he doesn't give up any concessions that we have, that he doesn't allow any new trade barriers to American goods and services from the United States going to Mexico and Canada, and that basically that he doesn't give up anything and doesn't go backwards in any way, only forward, which is one of the reasons why we're going to be going forward only to a small degree.
Well, and at the same time, Professor Matt Gold, the United States is one of only three parties in this renegotiation. Officials from Mexico have been warning that this is the worst possible political time for them to be doing this because they have an election coming up, I think next June, and any agreements that are reached, they're not sure if they can pass them.
That's correct. And negotiations would have to complete by January, February, or they'll have to be postponed for a full year because at that point, the Mexicans will be full on into their presidential campaign season. The election doesn't happen until, I believe, July 1. And then even after that, the new president doesn't take the oath of office until the following December 1. So it would be a year break. So there is a rush to get this done by January, February. I don't think that will happen, but they're going to try.
Well, before we let you go, you know, you mentioned environmental and labor standards that were key in this agreement. President Trump is pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Accords. Energy production is massive in all of these three countries, oil production and fossil fuels. How does our removal from Paris affect what people want to accomplish in the area of environmental protection? Because I'm sure they're connected.
Well, they are. Everyone is concerned about the Trump administration's commitment to the environment, and to refer to it as commitment to the environment might be a misnomer. It's lack of commitment to the environment. And so it becomes, for the first time, a concern of other countries that the United States will continue to meet international environmental standards. So for that reason and other reasons, it's considered very, very important that the environmental rules in NAFTA be brought into the main agreement and therefore enforceable.
New negotiations rejiggering the NAFTA deal start today in Washington, Canada, the United States, and Mexico. More negotiations to come. And Matt Gold, the Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for North America, the former one, says, really, they're just tinkering around the edges. They're not going to try to unscramble the eggs. Matt Gold, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
And let's stay now with our coverage of NAFTA because a renegotiation of that trade deal begins today. And because of that deal, agriculture and how North America trades in food is very different than it was 23 years ago when NAFTA came on the scene. America's total agriculture exports to Canada and Mexico went from $9 billion in 1993 to $41 billion in 2014. And those two countries are now by far America's biggest importer for products like corn and pork and beef. Now, the effect of NAFTA trade has also been felt among the workers in all three countries who've had to cope with a rapidly changing industry. Karen Hansen-Kuhn is here. She's Director of Trade and Global Governance at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Karen, welcome.
Hello.
I just mentioned a huge increase in trade to Canada and Mexico. So it seems like, at least in this sector, the U.S. has won big.
I think an interesting way to understand what's happened with agricultural trade is to look at the story of corn. Corn is hugely important in Mexico for both livelihoods and cultural reasons. And at the same time NAFTA began, we had a shift in U.S. farm policy that told farmers to get big or get out, that no matter how low the prices dropped, they should rely on exports to make up the difference. So after NAFTA, when the trade barriers were down, corn exports to Mexico increased 400%. More than 2 million Mexican farmers were driven out of agriculture. Some of those farmers went to cities, some came north, but they were off their lands. So maybe we think, well, so maybe Mexico lost. But in fact, in the U.S., it hasn't been so rosy either. We've lost more than 200,000 small and medium-scale farmers since NAFTA began. And some of that is about this idea of get big or get out. Farm prices have been really low. So what we've seen is more consolidation in agriculture, fewer very big farms, fewer very big companies controlling what happens. Of course, the bigger question is what it means for our food system.
Well, it sounds then like the winners may have been big corporate farm companies and the losers may have been the people who worked on farms before NAFTA.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think generally, if we look at what's happened in manufacturing, farming, and other sectors, the trade agreement is set up to facilitate flows of investment and trade. So the way it is written, which I have to say is not the only way it could be written, tends to favor those bigger actors.
Do we know then, Karen, what in the agriculture chapter the Trump administration may be going for in a renegotiation? And is there any chance that the dynamics you're talking about might change at least a little bit in this renegotiation?
Well, if you talk to anyone in civil society groups in the three countries, the first thing we want is transparency. We want to know exactly what it is they're negotiating because we don't know. But what we've heard is that they want to insert a lot of the provisions from the failed Trans-Pacific Partnership. So our concern is that rather than fixing the problem we have, in agriculture they'll try and dismantle Canada's successful dairy supply management program. And in Mexico, they'll try and expand exports of genetically modified seeds, something that's been prohibited up to now.
It's a little bit confusing hearing you say that, Karen Hansen-Kuhn, because the president's platform when he was running for president was, of course, a NAFTA that was more friendly to American workers. Are you saying that that doesn't necessarily include small farmers or farm workers at all?
Well, it doesn't seem like it. I mean, and I agree, it is surprising. And one of the first things President Trump did in office was to withdraw from this failed Trans-Pacific Partnership, which for precisely the reasons many of us had been challenging it, and now they say, oh, well, that's the starting point. We want to go even beyond what they tried to do in that agreement. As I said, it's just starting, so it's an important time for people to be weighing in.
Karen Hansen-Kuhn, Director of Trade and Global Governance at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
On Monday, a web hosting company called DreamHost denied a warrant issued by the Justice Department back in July. That warrant demanded information, including roughly 1.3 million IP addresses of people who'd visited a website called disruptj20.org. Well, this warrant appears to be an attempt by the DOJ to gather more information on individuals suspected of participating in Inauguration Day protests that turned violent. On the day of President Trump's inauguration, police in Washington, D.C. arrested over 200 protesters and charged them with felony rioting. Nevertheless, DreamHost says that the request from DOJ violates the First Amendment rights of its users, and a hearing is scheduled for Friday in federal court. Nuala O'Connor is president and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Nuala, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be here again. Thanks, Todd.
What's the legal principle here that the government is using other than we want to know who's been on this website that coordinates protests?
Well, it appears that they want to see how the protests were organized and what the information provided by this company was to the people involved in the protest, which, you know, could have some legitimacy, but certainly we're talking about fewer than 200 people. Well, that's certainly a big number as well. But the request goes to all activities on the website. We're talking over 1.3 million visitors to the site, all of the users, contributors to the site. The mere click on a website should not require or allow the government to have your personal information and you end up in the dragnet of a law enforcement investigation.
Is there a legal precedent or a justification that supports DOJ's request for all of those 1.3 million IP addresses?
If there is, I haven't seen one. Now, we should note that these are not unusual requests. Websites and web hosting companies receive law enforcement requests about you or about customers every single day and have legitimate processes to respond, to ask them to be limited or more tailored. The biggest web hosting companies in America have received, you know, hundreds of requests probably every month. What's really concerning here, and it's really hard not to see this particular request as a form really of high-tech McCarthyism, is the scope of this request is so overbroad. If we were just talking about the owner or operator of the website and their identity so that the law enforcement people could interview or investigate, if we were talking about the people who have already been charged in a law enforcement investigation, again, I think the web hosting company and the company itself would probably push back. But here we're talking about every single visitor who may have clicked on the website. I went to the website last night. I hadn't been on it before, but I clicked on it. That would mean my personal information would be part of this law enforcement investigation. It's really just, it feels at least like a fishing expedition. And it's particularly fraught here because this is anti-government speech. And this is absolutely First Amendment protected speech in the sense that it is your right to redress and petition the government. And it's deeply concerning because of the content of this site.
And I want to ask, and I do want to ask you before we let you go about that First Amendment implication, because the company says that this request, as broad as it is violating the First Amendment speech and, I assume, assembly rights of people who visited the website. Is that likely to carry sway in the federal court?
I absolutely think that DreamHost is going to prevail and is doing the right thing here. That doesn't mean they're not going to have to turn over any information, but I think they will absolutely narrowly tailor this request at the hearing on Friday.
So that means what's likely then, in your view, Nuala O'Connor, that this wide net that's been asked for, that's been cast by DOJ, is likely to be narrowed by the court, and that the web hosting company may still wind up handing over significant information to the government.
It may have to hand over some, but I think it will be drastically reduced from this grossly overbroad, really digital dragnet that's been requested.
A warrant from the Department of Justice to the web hosting company DreamHost looking for information on people who visited their website, disruptj20.org, in front of President Trump's inauguration that led to violent protests last January 20th. Nuala O'Connor, President and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
...1939 began like any other year. Sydney, Australia hit a heat record. The first boxing match was televised that year. And in February, 22,000 Nazi supporters attended a German-American Bund rally at New York's Madison Square Garden.
Our boys and girls, fellow white Americans and other non-parasitic guests, every nation showing a decay and subversion in its political, economic, and social system will show the same symptoms in its religious and cultural life, too.
Some people noticed that event and thousands like it across Europe, but many more ignored them, including Harry Leslie Smith. He was just 16 in 1939, unaware of the threat that Adolf Hitler posed and of the threat of war.
It was surreal, actually. When you lived a sort of a sedate, hard-working life, you can't relate to it as a teenager. You're still green behind the ears, and we didn't have any real opinion because of the fact that we worked like hell. I mean, I was working quite often from 7 in the morning until 10 at night.
Then on September 1st of that year, Germany invaded Poland under the pretext of a fake attack on a German radio transmission tower.
NBC takes you now to Berlin, Germany. While awaiting the arrival of Adolf Hitler to address the Reichstag, the following description of the first bombing of Warsaw is supplied by the United Press. The bombardment began with heavy detonations outside the city. Apparently, most of them were anti-aircraft barrages, but some possibly were bombs. The explosions were almost continuous.
Suddenly, the world had changed and would remain changed forever. The foreign policy mandate of appeasement, followed by Britain and France, had allowed Germany to rearm, and the talk of a rising leader in Adolf Hitler was no longer just talk. His ambitions were plain. Harry Leslie Smith was 18 in 1941 when he enlisted in Britain's Royal Air Force. He says he sees some similarities between the eve of the Second World War and today.
Yes, I think what I've seen so far is a collapse of actual countries. We seem to have lost a grip of what is right and what is wrong in our countries. We have allowed it to be sort of taken to pieces. We have allowed it to be actually stolen, because the 1% of all the Western countries today, I think, are just loaded with corrupt people who are running the countries and not. But I see this whole thing as, for me at the moment, the main problem to me is the Trump campaign, because it seems to me that he has no idea what he is doing. He is going to ruin the United States. He's going to finish up possibly having riots in the streets. I keep wondering, all those men and women who he promised to get good jobs for, what is going to happen when once they realize that it's pie in the sky? He doesn't mean anything about what he says. Are they going to be rioting? Are they going to be saying, enough, enough is enough? Because it only needs something like that to get the whole country in the turmoil. Right now, the people, they're dead scared that they're not going to have health care. And I know from my own past, the thought of no health care is really, really a serious matter. Both parties, they have to put aside their differences. They have to realize that the main thing that they should be concerned with is the future, the present and the future of that great United States, where in the old world used to say that the U.S. actually was the birthplace of democracy and innovation. Where did it go?
I'm sure you saw the events that transpired in Charlottesville, Virginia over the last few days, and I'm sure that you saw the president's reactions to it. What were your reactions to what you saw?
I think any sane person in the United States looks at Trump and says, what is he doing? He's agreeing to making it a sort of a fascist country there, which I'm sure no one in their right minds would want to be a part of.
Well, Harry Leslie Smith, you lived through World War II. You lived through 1938 and 1939, and you've written about it extensively. And it makes me want to ask you here what your warning is for the United States at this moment.
My warning to the United States, well, I would say wake up to reality, because the world is dying to see the old United States. The United States, which was fair and honest and believed in just in being a normal person and allowing their social justice to take over, you know.
Author, World War II veteran, and Englishman, Harry Leslie Smith. Sir, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Harry Leslie Smith's new book is Don't Let My Past Be Your Future. It'll come out in September. Well, do you have friends or family members who were alive during World War II? What do they see? What do they tell you about what they see when they look at the country today?
Hi, I'm Tina. I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri. My father was in World War II at Normandy. He is incensed and practically speechless at what he sees now. He said he can't believe that he risked his life to fight against a hell that is possibly developing roots in our nation where we're supposed to be free.
This is Jane Stackhouse from Portland, Oregon. I'm 70, so my parents are about both now deceased, and they both lived through World War II. My mother was always clear with us growing up. All people are equal and should be treated with empathy and respect. She would be shouting at President Trump for trying to minimize the danger of the alt-right.
This is Barry Wynn calling from Brighton, Michigan. My family members of that era, though disappointed, are not particularly surprised by the current racial climate. They know firsthand how low people can go. To them, all that has changed is the calendar date.
Your reactions to this moment in American history in the aftermath of Charlottesville and the aftermath of the president's remarks yesterday in New York. You can always give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can send your tweets to us at The Takeaway, and you can tweet me at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state that has instituted and prioritized the Learn to Code movement in K-12 education. Learn more about the Computer Science Initiative at arkansasedc.com. And LegalZoom, working to help Americans take control of their families and assets with an estate planning kit, which includes an informational ebook and other resources. More information available at LegalZoom.com/prepare.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.